Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi everybody, welcome back. It's been quite a while, I think. Welcome to Wild Wild Podcast. This is the 8th film, I think, now in a season of post-apocalypse films. So we're approaching the end game, if you will. Although actually we've done that one already.
We've passed the end game.
Yeah. My name is Adrian, and I'd like to welcome my ever reliable co-host Rod Barnett. Welcome, Rod.
I'm glad to be here. Glad to be back talking about these crazy films. I love them.
Yeah. Now, Rod, I thought before we start, we'd play a quick game, if you'll bear with me. So we have listeners all over the world, and so I thought it would be fun if you could name a country, and then I will tell you how many downloads we've had in that country.
Oh, okay. Japan.
And there are quite a few. Japan. Oh, I saw Japan on the list. Japan, we have had 43 downloads.
Cool. Good.
If you're listening, say hi.
Yeah, exactly. We need to do more to penetrate the Japanese market, and that came out completely wrong.
Okay, give me another one.
Australia.
Australia. Actually, Australia is our 1, 2, 3, 4th most popular country. We've had over 500 downloads in Australia.
Cool.
Which, maybe it's the Mad Max connection with this season. I don't know.
It could be.
I mean, today's film is basically The Road Warrior, so...
Oh, well, don't give it all away.
No, wait. Okay, try another one. Maybe a bit more of an obscure country this time.
Oh, okay. I'll go European and go with, say, Belgium.
Belgium. Okay. Belgium, we have had 74 downloads in Belgium. We have the most listeners in Brussels, in Belgium, of that 74 downloads.
It gets that granular? You can get it down
a
city?
Yeah. So, yeah, we've had 54 listeners. Or maybe it's people who are all members of the European Parliament just checking in.
Of course.
Yeah, maybe. So, do you want to guess where our most popular country is?
Probably the United States.
It is, yes. And to continue the game a bit more, which city do you think listens to us the most?
Which city?
Yeah, have a go. We're actually listened to in quite a lot of cities, many of which I've never heard of.
Wow, that's a tough choice. Oh, let's gamble and say Los Angeles.
It is Los Angeles.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I honestly did not think that was going to be true.
Yeah.
Wow.
But we are the most popular in Los Angeles. So, again, if you're listening, whoever you are out there, get in touch. Let us know who you are. It'd be cool to hear from you all. We could also, I'll just give you a couple more before we finish, because I think this is really cool.
It is.
We have listeners in Poland. We have been downloaded in Pakistan. Russia, Indonesia, we have listeners in Hong Kong. People have downloaded us in Mumbai, Peru, which is quite fun. Yeah, we've had 53 downloads in Lima, Peru.
Nice.
So we are a global podcast here, Rod. I don't know how accurate this is, but we've had one download in Iran.
Really?
Which, yeah, which is interesting.
Well, I guess, okay.
Yeah, I mean, great. Whoever you are, please get in touch.
let us know.
Yeah, just loads of countries. So anyway, I thought that was quite exciting when I last looked at that to see where we are listened to, and just be great to hear from you, and you know, let us know who you are and where you are and all that. We do get people. I have got one email which I'll share with you at the end, but yeah, wherever you are in the world, I guess, you know, maybe wherever we are at the moment, we're all thinking about the fact that we might be approaching some kind of post-apocalypse. So
yeah,
people are just, you know, looking for podcasts that are tackling the serious issues, and and here we are.
Well, just out of curiosity, what's the temperature been like in your neck of the woods the past few days?
Roasting. I mean, today's actually cooled down, but the last month was the hottest June in the history of the UK.
Yuff.
And I spend most of the month frying. My son couldn't sleep at night in his bedroom because he's up on the attic and it was too hot.
Oh, my God.
We've all just been melting because I'm right on the south coast. Actually, Eastbourne is the hottest. No, what is it? The sunniest place in the UK.
Oh.
Like officially. So, yeah, very hot. Hot at work. My students are all too hot. Well, everyone's just too hot. How about you?
Well, that's just it. I know that the comparisons will be difficult because you guys have use the Celsius scale and we use the Fahrenheit. But the big plus, I think, for the Fahrenheit scale all comes down to when it gets to be too warm, because we can honestly say things like it was 100 degrees, and we're being accurate, because yesterday it was late in the afternoon, a friend came over and we got in my car to go to a local restaurant to eat, and my car has we'll tell you the exterior temperature, and it registered a 101 when we got in the car, and we managed to get it down. It was lower than that once we came out of the restaurant about an hour and 20 minutes later. It was only 98.
Hey.
Yeah, it's ridiculously hot.
You need a jumper.
It's just madness.
Yeah.
And so I know that as far as the Celsius scale is concerned, we'll hear someone dealing with Celsius say, "My goodness, it was 40," and we were like, I'd beg for 40 right now.
No, we're not, certainly not 40 degrees here. I mean, that would be very hot. But yeah, we are melting. I mean, this film, I think in particular, seems quite appropriate for the current climate that we are in. So this episode, we are talking about a film called The Exterminators of the Year 3000. Also known, its original title, Il Giustiziere della Strada. And I was trying to work out the translation of that. And it kind of, if you just do a full Google Translate of the whole title, it comes back as the Highwaymen, which doesn't make a lot of sense. But the Giustiziere, can't even say it, is kind of like a lawbringer or like a judge, a justice of the peace. So it seems like the Italian title is playing on the cops, which only a part of this film throughout the first 5 minutes. So it's very confusing. And
that is very strange.
Yeah. And the Exterminators of the Year 3000 is not that much more of a helpful title, although it is the Year 3000. But there's a car which is referred to as the Exterminator.
Yeah.
there are a bunch of people out in the desert who, according to the IMDb, are the evil exterminators, but I don't think they're ever actually referred to as such in the film, so it's a bit odd. But who, you know, never let a title get in the way of a good story, I guess. So, yeah, Exterminators of the Year 3000, directed by Giuliano Carmineo, who is very prolific and made a lot of westerns, which, of course, this film was shot in and around Almeria. I mean, there's basically a film where they managed to get away with building no sets, I think. Maybe
oh,
one.
I know.
Because they just shot the whole thing outside in the desert. And they shot it in the same locations as all the spaghetti westerns were just a few years before.
Uh-huh.
So this director sometimes went under the name of Anthony Ascot. He did do another film in this area, this region. Is it Ratman?
Yeah, 1988.
Is that a kind of post-apocalypse film? I've never seen that one.
No. It's a horror film.
That's a horror film. Oh, never mind.
Yeah, and it's one that I can honestly say I've been meaning to watch it for a very long time and still have not gotten around to it. I feel kind of embarrassed to a degree because I've known about it and been curious about it for a very long time and still have not actually pushed play.
Oh, right. Yeah, me neither. But he did do, most better known for doing four of the Sartana films.
Yep.
There are more than four of those, right?
I think, depending on how you count, there may be between 5 and 250, but I'm not positive.
Good point.
Yeah. So, but he kind of is known as one of the creators of the Sartana stuff, the Sartana films in general. That's what he's most famous for as your spaghetti Western aficionados are concerned.
But he did also do The Case of the Bloody Iris, the giallo.
Which is a really popular one. That's a great one, yeah.
So he's done obviously in the 70s some of the sex comedies and things like that, as well as they all did. We don't need to dwell on that too much, don't worry. But yeah, so really prolific and interesting director, again, going back to the sort of early 60s. He did one of the Ringo films, which of course there are loads of those too.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, so I think apart from Sartana and the Giallo, most of these films I'm not familiar with. Again, with the like as we said before, with all the comedies, they tend not to travel. So with a lot of these directors, there's a big chunk of their filmography that you just no one outside of Italy has seen.
This is true. And the thing is, to be straightforward, we as exploitation fans, we're only ever really interested in seeking out the things that fit into nice, neat little genres that we get curious about. And so we do miss out on a certain number of, well, let's put it this way. Not a lot of Italian dramas get the exploitation treatment or the are desired by people who are interested in, post-apocalyptic films. And so even if directors did dip their toes into, say, courtroom dramas or anything of that nature, chances are good that we may never see them. And because there just didn't seem to have been a market for that kind of thing outside of the home country where they were marketed. And so they may not even have an English dub, depending on when they were produced. So, So you can look at very long career and his large number of credits and think to yourself, wow, I wonder what some of these are. And as soon as you start digging into them, you start to realize, so nobody saw a market for this outside of maybe just Europe,
And one of the writers, I think he's a returning writer for the podcast, Dardano Sacchetti.
Oh, yes.
Pretty sure we've talked about him before, who's written a whole ton of great stuff. But most of the stars of the film, with one notable exception, are not really people who did much. We've got our star whose character name, I don't know why, but his character's name is called Alien.
Yeah, which is odd, to say the least.
No sense to that at all. Played by Robert Iannucci. And I've tried looking stuff up about him, and there's not much out there. He only did three films.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, two films and a TV show. So
Well, the good news is that the American Blu-ray has an interview with him.
Oh, really? Oh, I don't have that.
Yeah, Code Red, when they initially did a Blu-ray for the film, and then they found him, interviewed him, even had him do a sat down and do a kind of running commentary track as well.
Oh.
And so what it is he was a Calvin Klein model who got pulled into doing those few movies that he did almost by chance, mainly because of his I almost said broker. That makes him sound like a hooker. Mainly because of his agent, who got him, this was his first film. He only did a few others.
Yeah.
Went back to doing what he was much better known for, and these days, you know, has done a number of different things and is doing quite well. Still lives in California, but it is interesting to hear his recollections of the process of making the film and everything. And the shock to me was that although I knew almost nothing about him, I was kind of surprised that he comes off as well as he does in this film.
And doesn't he look like Franco Nero?
A little bit.
Yeah, he does. It's really striking, I thought.
And I think
maybe
that's
one of the reasons they cast him.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, no, he's very good. Just, it's an interesting sort of anti-hero character. And then he has a sort of love interest and a character played by Alicia Morrow, whose name is Trash.
Yeah.
Which I thought was funny.
I know.
Pretty sure we've heard that name before.
More than a few times. And
yeah.
Trash as a name is something that, I don't know, it doesn't usually conjure up the best ideas in your head for what the character is going to be. But
no.
In this case, she's kind of the voice of reason and the moral center of a lot of this.
Yeah. And a couple of others worth mentioning, Eduardo Fajardo. Because this is obviously a Spanish co-production,
yeah.
Which I'm assuming means you know a lot more about, or you recognize more of these people than I do. But he's an interesting guy who's been in tons of stuff.
Oh, definitely.
Including lots of spaghetti westerns.
Well, having run across him repeatedly doing the Nashi cast,
yeah.
Not necessarily just in Nashi related films, but also in films that you know genre films made in Spain. He's somebody who's I always get a kick out of spotting him because he's got a distinctive face and he's also very very good. He's been in so many movies. I mean the list of spaghetti westerns alone that he was in the 60s is as long as your arm. But his career started back in the late 40s. He's one of those guys who was just always working somewhere in the film industry in Europe. I mean, he was in. For people listening to this show, you might have seen him in Sabata.
Mm-hmm.
You might have seen him in Compañeros, or oh my goodness, the Two Faces of Fear. Rico the Mean Machine. He's in Rico the Mean Machine. He's in Lisa and the Devil for Mario Bava. He's in The Killer Must Kill Again, which is something that we, of course, covered here on the show.
But yeah.
And the list of his credits go on and on. Recently, he's got a wonderful role in Murder Mansion or Maniac Mansion, depending on where you're finding your print of it, which has finally been released on Blu-ray over here in the States a few years ago.
That's in the Vinegar Syndrome box, isn't it?
One of the Vinegar Syndrome boxes. But, you know, as for the spaghetti westerns, I mean, he was in The Mercenary. He was in so many films. He even had a role in Argo Man, The Fantastic Superman. I mean, he's all over the place. And, of course, a lot of people are going to single him out because he's kind of unmistakable once you see Django as well as he plays Major Jackson in that film.
Yeah.
Eduardo Fajardo, I'm so terrible with pronouncing Spanish names.
It
should have been a crime for me to get interested in Spanish cinema of any type. But he is he's amazing, and he's having him in this was just an extra bonus. I just wish he was in it a little bit more.
Yeah, and ironically, considering his history riding horses around the deserts of Almeria, he's basically indoors for this entire time he's on screen. He doesn't get out into the desert much. One last name worth mentioning as well is Fernando Bilbao, another Spanish actor, I think, who has been in Jess Franco films and Antonio Margheriti films. And he plays the, what's his name? Like Sitting Bull? Chief Bull?
Crazy Bull.
Crazy Bull, yeah. Yeah. He's very much modeled on the sort of Mad Max bad guys.
Yes, exactly.
Mohawk and speaking a kind of Shakespearean dialogue, which is weird.
I know, but that sometimes works effectively and sometimes makes you go, oh, they really should have allowed the actors to. That's one of the things that came out of the interview with Robert Antonucci is the English speakers in the cast were constantly attempting to get the director to let them kind of smooth out the dialogue on the page because it was a rough English translation from Italian,
right.
And they were never allowed to do that, which is why the dialogue is, shall we just say, is memorable. Because it is sometimes so clunky and weird. Because they would not let them alter the dialogue at all. I guess they didn't trust them to do it. So that's it. It's crazy.
Yeah, Fernando Bilbao, in the same year, 1973, he was in Antonio Margheriti's Mr. Hercules Against Karate, or Ming Ragazzi. Not very good.
It's an absolutely terrible film. It's in the category of possibly Margheriti's worst film.
Yeah,
I don't know.
But in that same year, he's also in The Vampire's Night Orgy, which, I mean, that's got your name all over it, surely.
Oh, yeah. I really enjoy that film. I think it's a blast.
And The Erotic Rites of Frankenstein.
And I enjoy that film, too, although not as much as Vampire's Night Orgy.
All 1973, which is a pretty good year for him.
He must have been swimming in wine.
Yeah, loads and loads and loads of stuff. I'm missing out one, perhaps the most famous name in the whole film, because I'm going to save that for when he turns up on screen. And we'll talk about him.
I know who you're obviously talking about, but I would like to bring up Alicia Morrow, who plays the lead. I would like to point out one thing about her, which is that it was really bugging me going back and watching this film, because I kept trying to imagine. I was trying to put my finger on where do I know her from, because there's something about her. And then I realized, she was in Slugs and Edge of the Axe.
Jose Larraz, right?
Well, Slugs is Juan Piquer Simon.
Oh, yes.
Famous for Pieces and other completely crazy films.
Yes.
And Edge of the Axe is by the esteemed Jose Larraz. And I absolutely love both of those films, one for one reason and one for another reason. So, But yeah, I was trying so hard to figure out. It's like I know that face. There's something about it that's ringing a bell, and it's because I've probably watched Slugs far too many times and Edge of the Axe. I know I've watched too many times. So yeah.
Okay. So shall we? Oh, we haven't even mentioned our little hero Tommy as well, Luca Vincentini, who's a sort of child actor who manages to not be irritating, which is good, but. He's probably more recognizable to most people for being in City of the Living Dead, Gates of Hell.
Yeah.
So he's in that around the same time, I think. So he's just like one of those child actors. But then he's grown up and mostly been in Italian TV since then. But yeah, he's just worth mentioning, I think, for City of the Living Dead, which is always good for a laugh.
I love that film.
Should we ever go at the plot? So I'm using the book here, as usual, After the World Ends, when post-apocalyptic movies were telling the future. And once again, because this has been translated from French, and it's very poetic in its plot description, so I'm not going to read it all, but In fact, they basically spend most of the article just with the opening of the film. The year is 3000, and the atom god spat out his wrath on the folly of men. And this sounds like it was written by Crazy Bull. That's how he speaks.
Yes, it does.
The world woke up in a daze, metamorphosed into an immense dust wasteland. The final explosion not only ravaged the landscape, it also turned the atmosphere upside down, and rains have now become a thing from the past. I feel like I need some suitable background music to read this.
Dun, 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 dun.
Yeah. Dun, dun, dun. Reduced to using groundwater, humanity already has one foot in the grave. So that's basically before we even start the film. All right, that's where we're at. But the film actually starts with a police car, American, obviously, driving through the desert with two cops who are being told to return to headquarters by a robot. And they're like, oh, we're not going to listen to no robots. And they just drive. They seem to be driving around trying to maintain law and order,
I guess.
But it's really weird because once they are basically dispatched of by our hero, that's the end of them. And we don't know whose law and order they were reinforcing, because for the rest of the film, we're led to believe there is no law and order.
I know. Starts out, the opening sequence gives you the impression that there's some
there's a society.
Yeah, a society or a government or some kind of authority someplace.
Yeah.
And there clearly is not.
No. But it also, obviously, I think it very much gives the impression that we're in Mad Max territory. So you might be forgiven, particularly if you were Italian and you read the Italian title, for thinking that these police guys are going to be our heroes. But it doesn't take long before they're not the heroes. Because
do you think that that was a choice? Do you think that that's what they thought they were doing there, which is they were setting the audience up to think that those were going to be the main characters of the film?
Maybe it's a deliberate switcheroo.
Yeah, I don't know.
Or, who knows? But it's fun. I mean, what it leads to is a great car chase, as Alien turns up in his tricked out Exterminator, which is a car that has bulletproof shields that open and close on the windows.
Yeah.
And inside it's got like cameras and computers and all this kind of stuff. And we're treated to our first car chase. And I have to say, I was really impressed with the action scenes in this film.
I'm glad you said that, because, man, I was too. This is
really
a film.
Good.
This is a film built around, I mean, not to the point of you feel like there's nothing else going on in the movie, but it's built around a number of really great action set pieces. And almost always there's a chase of some type involved. And, they're good. They're actually interesting and inventive. And talk about holding your interest. I mean, they're very effective, well shot. Well done. The stunts are very well accomplished. I was thoroughly happy with that.
Yeah, I mean, some of them look really dangerous. I mean, I know that's, that's partly the point, but you have to wonder. Some of them did seem really dangerous. There is one where a car rolls and you can see the guy's white helmet inside as the car flips over, which was a relief to know that the driver did have a helmet on, because he looked really bad. I think this is possibly, I mean, we've seen a few car chases across this season, but I think this might be the best choreographed action, certainly closest to the kind of Mad Max 2 vehicle action that they're going for.
Yeah, it's very effectively shot and done. And I got to say, I'm very impressed with the effective use of slow motion photography in these action sequences as well. They really knew how to deploy this. These sequences really show that the director knew how to film this stuff and had enough experience to actually be able to put this stuff together effectively. There's some great action stuff in this movie.
Yeah, because so Alien at one point, so he gets out of the car to check that the police are dead now or disposed of. I think he's run one of them over. I can't remember. But anyway, whilst he does that, somebody steals his car and races off. So he jumps into the police car, chases after them, and we get another car chase. But this car chase ends with him flipping off a cliff and ending like the car is upside down and crushed, and he is stuck inside the car. And then we leave him and we move off to somewhere else. Just
the movie goes on.
When we leave him for a little while to wonder who was this guy and what's happening now. So meanwhile, I'll carry on with the poetic plot description here. So a small community has achieved the impossible, sheltered in the bowels of the earth and in the hope of better days. They have saved representatives of a few species of animals and recreated a semblance of agriculture. But the water that made the miracle possible is running out, and only mud comes from the pumps. Now, can't you just squeeze mud and get water out of it?
That's just it.
This is just my thought, my first thought.
Mud, actually, I don't want to confuse people. Follow me if you can. But mud requires water. Yeah. To make mud, one must have moisture.
Yeah.
And so if one were to take mud and put it on things that need water, they would have water.
Yeah. Well, you could, you know, if I'm like, put the mud out in the heat and then capture the moisture as it evaporates. And
I can think of half a dozen ways to conjure water from mud, but nevertheless.
Who are we to criticize their systems? So this is where we meet Tommy, the young boy who is sitting watching across the wasteland from this base that they've got, because it turns out that his dad went off with a tanker to try, because they know where water is. Which my first question was, why did they build their place where there is none? But I guess...
Good question.
I guess there was. There was water, but it's running out. So they've sent somebody off in a tanker to get somebody. He hasn't come back yet. But the whole society is going to die if this one guy that's gone out into the wasteland doesn't come back.
Uh-huh.
And that's a bit of a problem. And his mum is one of the scientists. And this is where we meet the senator, Eduardo Fajardo, who's basically telling them they've just got to pray that everything will be fine. Meanwhile, everyone else is complaining, look, we've got to go, let's send more people out, and so on and so on. Eventually, it's agreed that a new convoy is going to go and find the water. Tommy, of course, he wants to go, but they won't let him. But I'm sure we've seen this in 100 movies. They're heading down the road, they hear a noise, they open the curtain. Hey, there's Tommy. With, of course, his pet hamster, which presumably is because they're trying to keep the animals alive as well. They've got like a bit of a Noah's Ark situation going on.
I don't know. Before we get too far past this, we should point out that the actor playing a lot of great actors, a lot of very familiar faces. The actor playing the little boy's father, who shall we say, doesn't last long in this film. He's a very familiar face as well, one that we have run across in just this podcast alone, my friend. Verentino.
Oh, hang on. Who are we talking about?
Venatini.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. That's not his father. That's the other guy who says.
Oh, is he not? Oh, that's not. Okay. So, but it's one of the. He's along on that tanker truck.
Yeah. He says, let's go out and we need
that's
to send another
right.
truck.
He's the other guy.
He's the one who persuades them to go out. Well, I know I've seen him in Cannibal Ferox, but what film have we seen
him
in? Oh,
we saw him in The Humanoid.
That was a long time ago now.
I know, we both slept since then. He was in a bazillion different things. I mean, a couple of the Emmanuel films, Young, Violent, and Dangerous.
We did that one.
Yep. I mean, exactly. And he's one of those guys who's a very, once again, distinctive face. He was in City of the Living Dead. He was in The New Barbarians, which is one that we've kind of danced around. He's in a lot of movies, and he's another one of those craggy face Italian actors who seems to be able to play lots of different kinds of roles. And I mean, he even pops up in a small role in Richard Donner's 1985 film Lady Hawk. So he's just in a whole lot of movies, and of course his career stretches back into the 60s as well, popping up in a few spaghetti westerns and even a few larger international productions like The Agony and the Ecstasy and things like that.
Oh, and he's the priest in Seven Deaths in the Cat's
Exactly,
Eye.
Which is where you and I have talked about him before,
which
over on the Bloody Pit.
We've also done that.
Yeah.
Wow. this guy, he could be like our lucky charm. And he only died about 5 years ago, and he was still acting right up to the end.
Yeah, I don't know that anybody who was in Emmanuel in Bangkok needs to ever be anybody's lucky charm. But yeah, he could be.
Yes. So yeah, you're right. So he's the guy who persuades the senator to let them try again. And Tommy hides in his truck.
Yeah.
But yeah, Tommy's dad.
Oh, Tommy's dad, but yeah, he didn't.
I got a bit confused because of the way they cut it together. We've just seen Alien get trapped in his car.
Yeah.
And then we cut to Tommy looking out into the desert, worrying about his dad. That sort of narrative structure made me assume straight away that Alien was Tommy's dad.
I don't know. No, yeah.
But I mean, he's not.
No, he's not.
But just the way they put that together, your dad isn't back. I assumed for a while that meant this guy was his dad. Which, of course, maybe that's just setting us up for the ending of the film.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah, that's a good way to look at it.
He does become a kind of surrogate parent. But yeah, so they head off into the desert, but they're only about 5 minutes out when they immediately get attacked by Crazy Bull.
And I would just like to say, my for all the faults that I want to lay at the feet of the poorly translated English dialogue, I got to tell you that for my money, throwing the phrase mother grabbers into every scene that they could throw it into.
Come on, you mother grabbers.
I swear that is one of the best things about this movie. I mean, what is a mother grabber? There's a lot to be asked about that question, but that is the phrase that our main villain, who looks like he was an extra or attempting really hard to pretend that he was the main character villain in Road Warrior, he throws that phrase out there. Be you someone he hates or loves, apparently. A term of possible endearment? I don't know.
And he's got this whole clan in with tricked out cars, with spiked wheels, motorbikes, the whole works. It's like he's borrowed them from the Atlanteans from the last episode.
Or, somebody grabbed a bunch of stuff and off the set of the Road Warrior and ran with it.
But it does look good. I have to say that they have, there's a lot of chase scenes that go on, and they are jumping across from vehicles, and there's a wide shot when they're chasing the convoy, and you can see in the wide shot that somebody on their motorbike just like falls off. They have an accident, which presumably wasn't meant to happen, but they've just left it in the film anyway. So you just see this bike flip out as they're all driving across the desert, and then there's loads more action and bike jumps and chases, and it's really good.
The action in this is the reason to come to this movie. Don't get me wrong. If you're a fan of this genre, the post-apocalypse genre, it's a must-see. And I just as an aside, I can't believe it took me as long as it did to finally see this movie. I never caught up with this until it came out on Blu-ray.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, this was a first-time watch for me. And so it's interesting because, again, whereas Mad Max 2 was all about tankers and protecting the oil reserves, this film, they've just switched oil for water and kept a lot of the same ideas.
Yeah, now that happened.
These tankers driving across the desert, but it's water they're after.
That change from, petrol to water is something that a lot of these post-apocalyptic films did, which, is a very logical choice to make as far as trying to get across the idea of working hard to survive in a rough environment. And it does make you wonder why we never, in The Road Warrior, no one ever thinks, where are they getting their water? Aren't they out there in the middle of nowhere? It's just that the movie the movie keeps you distracted with the actual story and all the action, so you don't ever consider that.
But and so I want to jump ahead really, because we're still only at the beat, like the first 10 minutes of the film. So basically, Crazy Bull manages to take out everybody from this convoy with the exception of Tommy. He's the one survivor. He manages to escape, and he's wandering across the desert, and then he discovers, or he hears a sound, and it is, of course, alien in his stuck in his upside down car.
Yep.
And this is where I thought it was going to be a Father Tommy reunion, which I was wrong about. But this is, so he meets Alien, and this is quite a sassy kid, and he's like, yeah, why should I rescue you? What's in it for me? But now this is something else where I got confused, because the kid starts saying to him, well, do you know where there's a tanker? I need a tanker to go and get the water. And all I kept thinking was, you just had a tanker. What's wrong with that one? Like, he's just left. He's left his other tanker in the middle of nowhere. Why didn't he just go back to... I don't know. That seems a bit strange. But anyway, so they meet and lots of stuff happens, I think it's fair to say.
Many things.
He agrees to help him. But before he can help him... Now, I'm slightly losing track of where I am. But I think that's where he has a fight again with Crazy Bull. Crazy Bull turns up. And Crazy Bull is annoyed with Alien because it turns out that the Exterminator was his car.
Right.
So at some point, Alien has nicked Crazy Bull's car, which seems like the wrong kind of guy to antagonize.
Unless you think that by stealing the car, you could get far enough away from him that he couldn't get you.
Get away from him.
That did not work out.
So Alien, they have a bit of a fight, and Tommy's arm gets pulled off. Oh, no, Tommy's... What is it that's happened? Oh, yeah, they're trying to torture Tommy to find out where the water is.
Right.
And Tommy's arm gets pulled off. And Alien takes him somewhere to get his arm fixed, but also where he knows there will be a tanker.
Well, wait. If people who have not seen this film, we should point out that it is not his actual arm.
Well, no. That's a good point.
He has. It is this child,
prosthetic arm.
This child, being in a film that took place after the 1970s existed, has a bionic arm.
Yes. And so it's broken, but luckily Alien knows who can put it back together. So he takes him to this compound where we get to meet none other than Pag himself.
Ah, yes.
In his best Pag beard. Well, we're talking, of course, about Luciano Pigozzi, a.k.a. Alan Collins.
A.k.a. And I the Italian Peter Lorre, yes.
I want to say, isn't 1983 the same year as Yule?
Around the same period
of
time.
It's very close.
Depending on when you date Yule, The Hunter from the Future. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Because there's the television version, there's the film version. So,
yes,
yeah.
True. It's possible that he flew straight from Turkey to Almeria to shoot this.
Could be possible.
Now, I always love it when he turns up in a movie that's not an Antonio Margheriti film. Because, you know, we're expecting him in the Margheriti movies. But when he just turns up in randomly, it's almost like you forget that he was an actor that was in loads of stuff. It's almost like I just tend to think of him as being in Margheriti's pocket the whole time, you know, and Margheriti just pops him out ready for a film. But actually, no, he was an actor. He did loads of other films.
Lots of other films.
So, yeah, it's always nice when he turns up. And he's a kind of gifted mechanic and engineer who, before the apocalypse, was an astronaut who went to Mars, apparently.
I know. I love how they just they use sidelong pieces of dialogue to kind of give you this wider world, this history, and it's completely It's almost always something where you just sit there thinking, well, could we see that movie? Where's the movie about that little adventure? Hang on a second.
I want to see Luciano Pigozzi on Mars.
Exactly.
That would have been amazing. So just to kind of speed things through here, because we're still only in the first act. So he agrees, fine, after arguing with Alien, he agrees to fix this kid's arm, but the only anesthetic he's got are loads of cans of beer. So he gets Tommy really drunk and operates on him to fix his arm. Then Alien pops outside and finds the Exterminator. So the car is there. And he also bumps into Trash, who it turns out is some kind of ex-girlfriend, I think. And she is the one who stole the car in the first place.
Right.
So now we've got our kind of core team together here, who are going to go and find the water. Alien is pretending that it's because he wants to help Tommy save his people, but really he just wants to sell the water to the highest bidder.
Yep.
Whereas Trash appears to be more altruistic and wants to help him save his people. And we could probably guess where it's going to go. But then, so they head off. They're all off on this adventure with another tanker and the Exterminator to fight Crazy Bull, find the water, which when they get to the water, it's being guarded by what looked like the henchmen of Lord Buckethead.
Okay. Yeah.
Which is quite fun. And if do you remember Lord Buckethead? What was that film that he was in that was like a Star Wars ripoff?
Oh.
Where the Darth Vader was called Lord Buckethead. Anyway, he's basically a guy with a bucket on his head. And that's what these guys all look like. They're guarding the water. So
for those who are unaware, we should probably point out that Lord Buckethead was a joke of a political candidate. Who tried to get into the British government repeatedly.
Look, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, so that's a good point. So Lord Buckethead is a character from this film originally, and then somebody took on that persona to campaign against Boris Johnson. But then the film company claimed... I wish I could remember what the film was. The film company claimed copyright on Lord Buckethead.
Well, the film Lord Buckethead was originally called Hyperspace from 1984.
They claimed copyright. So the guy that was the original Lord Buckethead changed his name to Count Binface. So now
I didn't know that.
Now
okay.
he's got a
that I didn't
yeah.
know.
So now he's got a bin on his face, and then a rival candidate of Lord Buckethead, who, sponsored by the film company, did take over. So now there's a Lord Buckethead and a Count Binface, both fighting the Uxbridge. I think it's Uxbridge South, whatever was Boris Johnson's constituency. So basically, when Boris Johnson was up, you know, in the election, he'd have to stand on the, he'd have to stand up there at the front to receive all of the votes next to Count Binface and Lord Buckethead. It's all very funny.
I do love that in British politics, a character from a 1984 film that no one took seriously can be adopted and turned into a way to just embarrass the living crap out of actual politicians.
Yep.
And just because it's a must hear, you need to know that Lord Buckethead's manifesto in the 2017 election was impressive, because what he promised was strong, not entirely stable leadership, which, quite honestly, could be a good description of British leadership from roughly 2017 to the current day. So
it's pretty funny. Anyway, that's really what came to mind when I saw those guys in the film. But so I don't want to say any more. But so we've got our core team here. We've got surrogate mum, surrogate dad. We've got Tommy,
surrogate grandfather
with Papillon, as I think he's called.
Yep.
And the poster for Exterminators of the Year 3000, the main image is Tommy raising his fist in a kind of, it's almost like the sort of Black Power salute they've got him doing on the poster.
I know, and his hand, in the poster art, his hand is glowing, which I guess is supposed to indicate that maybe there was going to be more to his bionic arm than they could actually afford.
And his heart is as well, which is kind of strange.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
But it's because what's happened is Papillon has powered him up, so he's got a super bionic arm now, which comes in very useful later on, because he can throw stones that are basically act as bullets.
I'm sorry, I just can't stop laughing. Super bionic arm. It's true, and yet I just wasn't prepared for that phrase.
I know. It's great, isn't it? So yeah, he could take people out with his stones because he can throw them so hard. And yeah, so then it's just, you know, it's a chase to get to the water. Can they get the water before his people all die of thirst? What I will say is the ending of this film, and I'm not going to give it away, was very unexpected.
Yeah.
And there is a bit of a deus ex machina, which doesn't make any
sense
at all.
It's not a bit of a deus ex machina. It is a massive, holy crap, deus ex machina. God has literally descended from the sky, essentially.
it's the literal definition, isn't it? Because this comes out of nowhere. It's very funny. So the ending is a bit of a left field left turn, but just watch it and see is what I'll say. But yeah, this has been one of my favorites of all the post-apocalypse films I've done so far, primarily because the action is so well staged, and there are some seriously good car crashes and jumps and flips, and all kinds of cool stuff.
There's almost no lag. The film never feels like it's kind of slowed down too much, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's very well paced. I mean, it's almost like it's pointing towards what they would do in Fury Road, where there's basically all of the Mad Max vehicles chasing a tanker for the whole film.
Now, I would say this. There are a couple of disappointments in this film. Overall, man, I enjoy this movie. But I have to say there are a couple little things where I felt like the movie kind of promised something and didn't deliver, and then didn't deliver on it. And I just wonder what the reasons might have been. First of all, at the very beginning of the film, when we first meet Alien, we see him use Ebola to the balls on a cord that you sling at someone that is supposed to entangle their limbs.
Yeah.
We see him use that once, giving you the impression that this is going to be something that reoccurs throughout the movie, and it doesn't.
Yeah.
It does not at all.
I think doesn't he cut someone's head off with it at one point?
That's just it. It's like,
I'm sure he does once.
Once it's done one time, and then we never see that weapon used again the rest of the film. And I would love to know why. I wonder if the intention was to actually
use it.
It's
quite hard.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's quite hard to film, I suppose.
I guess. I don't know. Also, along with that, I really wish they'd used, you know, the whole whacking people in the head with a stone thrown by a bionic arm more in the movie once that starts to happen, because that to me felt like, oh, this is great. What an incredible weapon to put in the hands of a kid who we're kind of rooting for the whole time. It's like, this is amazing. So I wish they'd used that a little bit more. And I do wonder if at some point the idea wasn't to put the bola in the bionic arm and kind of have him sling that and maybe cut somebody in half. That's just me wishing and hoping, people. That's not something that I have any indicator of. But
could have cut a whole car in half.
Now you're getting more ambitious than I did. Okay,
No, I agree. I mean, that would have been, But I guess, you know, time pressures often have a factor in these things, don't they? And all these kind of things. But yeah, it's a great film. Really fun.
I will say, though, that they never did convince me that it was the year 3000.
If it's the year 3000, nobody had built a new car
since the 1970s.
Like, how long ago was this apocalypse if they're still using the cars from the 70s?
That is an open question, because we will never get an answer. I do know why you might want to throw the word, you know, the year 3000 into the title of your post-apocalyptic film. But honestly, if they had just, especially when this film came out, if they had just said the year 2000 or 2050 or something like that.
But I suppose it sets it apart a little bit from all the others that have got 20-something in the title.
I guess in the fictional world of people who love post-apocalyptic films, by this time, whenever this film came out in 1983, we were already getting this roadblock, a bottleneck, perhaps, of all these dates taking place in various years that, you know, granted, they might be 30, 40, 50, 60 years away, but, you know, these films can't all exist together, can they? This is sad. We have to differentiate ourselves in a way that will definitely make it stand out. Yeah, the year 3000, sure, we'll go that far.
Yeah, it just makes it a bit different, but it's basically completely arbitrary. I think I said this was the 8th film, and I was wrong. This is actually the 7th film.
Okay, good.
So we've still got 3 more to go. Including, we're going back in time because we've got Warriors of the Year 2072 coming up. But
talk about another arbitrary date, yes.
Yeah, because if you think about it, we've had 1990, Bronx Warriors, 2020, Texas Gladiators, 2019, After the Fall of New York. So, 3000 is a bit different, I suppose, but ultimately completely arbitrary. I think that's basically it. So I think this is getting a 2 thumbs up, isn't it, from us?
Definitely. I'm appalled.
4 thumbs up.
I'm appalled at some of the ridiculous. It's got, well, let's put it, 2 thumbs up from us and 1 bionic thumb up, surely.
Yes.
But I'm appalled at reading some of the reviews on this film, even dating up to today, and people are just not really finding anything in this to enjoy, you know, giving it some kind of, you know, phrases like feeble sci-fi road film, It's like, no, dude, come on.
Yeah.
Were you recovering from an appendix surgery? Come on, this thing is fun.
What more can they want from? Yeah, what can they want from a film? So I thought we'd just finish. I've got an email that I'd like to read that was sent to us by Kurt. Thank you, Kurt. He starts by saying, please don't read this on air. I already bug certain podcasters way too much. But I did reply to say, we don't get bugged enough, so I was going to read it out. First, thank you for covering Raiders of Atlantis. I've been curious about it for a while, and now I have to pull the trigger on seeing it. I didn't realize the Atlanteans had super advanced technology now lost for tricking out 1950s hot rods. Thank you for rediscovering it. Yes, we discussed last time the Atlantean technology is slightly confusing, but
it's completely great, confusing
nonetheless.
It's one of the
but still good. So he picked up on something we said last time. Next, I'm pretty interested in the idea of a Jungle Girl mini season.
Ah, yes.
There's a lot of repetition between movies. How many single engine planes carrying small girls went down over the jungle anyway, and is all the wreckage visible from space? Excellent question.
It is an excellent. Did they all crash in the same area? Hey.
Yeah. But he said, I think there's enough to make exploration worthwhile. The movies go from innocent to quite dark.
Oh, yeah.
And then he mentions that both of the Gungala movies are available from Sinister Cinema, English-friendly editions.
Cool.
He says, Jungle Girls aren't plausible exactly, but Kitty Swan is the most athletic portrayer I've seen, and she looks like she can handle pretty much anything, even white men. It's a real tragedy what happened to her while filming a later jungle movie.
Yeah.
Which I'm not...
Yeah.
We'll get to that.
Yeah.
Not familiar. Then he just mentions the theme. A.F. Lavagnino composed a nice theme for the first Gungala movie. Nice enough to get reused in at least two separate Jungle Girl movies. Once I had these soundtracks, I had to get them. Beware, you might spend more money than you originally plan on. Well, I mean, isn't that always the way?
It's always that. As soon as you go down one of these genre rabbit holes, it becomes something that you fear the walls are going to cave in on you because you've gone far too deep.
Yes, exactly. But yeah, thank you, Kurt, for getting in touch. Always good to hear from you. So please do, anybody who's listening, if you've got favorite post-apocalypse films or just do want to talk to us about anything, really, we'd love to hear from you. There's the email, which is just wildwildpodcast@gmail.com. You can find us on Twitter and also on Instagram, or just stop one of us in the street.
If you live in Middle Tennessee or in Eastburg.
Yes. That's the other way. So, Rod, anything you want to mention before we finish?
No. I'm sorry that it has taken us over long to get a new episode out. Both of us have been working on some other projects, some of which we'll be at liberty to talk about in the future. A couple of things that we're doing together, as well as other adventures in podcasting. Yep. So, yeah.
Yeah, June has been quite the month.
Yes, it has.
I think we can say that we're recording a couple of commentary tracks, so that's going to be happening soon. I know at least one of those is going to be announced in about a month's time.
Ah, okay.
Because we're quite close to the release with that one. But anyway, more news as we can, when we can share it with you. But hopefully we will get to the end of this post-apocalypse season before the actual apocalypse.
And then we can move on to the mini-season.
The Jungle
Girls.
Yes,
the Jungle Girl mini-season, which it would be nice if we could get to it while the weather is still extraordinarily hot, but I have the feeling that we're not going to have to worry about that because I think it's going to be extraordinarily hot all the way into November.
Yes, and we will all be desperate for water, just like Tommy and his mum.
And at no point did anyone ever refer to him as the Bionic Boy.
Ah, yep. That would have been good.
I would have liked it.
It reminded me a little bit. Did you ever see a film in the 80s called Daryl, Daryl?
Oh, no. I'm aware of what it is, but I never did see it.
Yeah, about a robot boy. I loved that film when I was a kid. It spoke to me.
Is it to... Does it hold up? Do you have any ideas?
I don't know. I haven't seen it since about 1986. But I watched it a lot, and a kid who's about your age who's got bionic powers, fantastic.
Seemed like heaven, huh?
Yeah, I would have loved the Exterminators of the year 3000 when I was 10.
I guess Daryl would have been wish fulfillment for you at that age. And,
yes.
And Exterminators of the year 3000 would have been the height of madness after something like Road
yes.
Warrior, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, thank you, everybody, for listening. You get in touch with us, like I said. You can buy us virtual coffee. All the links are in the show notes and all that stuff. We will be back, hopefully, before the end of the summer.
Yes.
We'll try and we'll do our best. But until then, keep watching the skies or whatever. Or just keep watching films.
Or just keep watching the mud in Alamera, I guess.
Yes, absolutely. So I am Adrian, and I thank you for listening.
I am Rod.
Bye for now.
I am Rod Barnett. And now as we step all over each other, I'm Rod Barnett.
I don't know why I said that.
Who knows? we both get confused at the end of the show, no matter what we
do. In case people have forgotten who they're listening to by the time we get to
They could. They could.
Yeah, and probably for the best. Thanks, everybody. See you soon. Bye.
Bye. You know what? Keep all of that at the end because that's hilarious.
Your personal info, like addresses, phone numbers, and more, are collected and sold by data brokers. But Aura steps in, scanning the web, sending you alerts, and requesting your info be removed. Get Aura's full toolkit, including credit and transaction monitoring, a password manager, VPN, and more. Get a 14-day free trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety.